Again, in both cases, we are interested in provable analytical error bounds.
Okay. So how to approximate a quantum field? So I think the idea we have, isn't it, that we want to use tensor networks to develop new ansatz classes for quantum field theories. And especially on my side, I'm interested in rigorous solutions or rigorous approaches. Because I think it's valuable to have at least some idea what a good ansatz could be. And then maybe you can use that further on for numerical optimization or other things. But I think it's valuable to have some ideas what an analytic solution could be or a good approximation can be. Okay, and I will present, as I said, two results about how to use tensor networks, matrix product states, and MERA for approximating conformal field theories in 1 plus 1 spacetime dimension. So first, the quantum field theory, we all know that. It's a quantum field theory. It's a quantum theory which has a continuum degree of freedom. And this represents the variables of space and time. And actually, if you want to mathematically define the theory, we actually define it in terms of its correlation functions. Okay? Or in terms of the generating functional of these correlation functions, which is kind of the same. Okay? So it's natural in some sense to think of the quantum field theory as being given in terms of correlation functions. And of course, all sets of correlation functions will give us a state omega. But as Brian pointed out, in general, for physical questions, we are not interested in all kinds of correlation functions. For example, we know that they will diverge if we take two of them close to each other. So we have lots of entanglement in lots of short-range entanglement. Well, this object, isn't it, necessarily requires a Hilbert space, which is infinite dimensional. And actually, if you want to be mathematically precise, you can also show that the subsystem structure of that theory cannot be described by tensor products, of Hilbert spaces. Okay? This also has to do with the fact that at short distance you have infinite entanglement, and basically with infinite entanglement you cannot like write down a tensor product. You can prove that. Of course, in some sense, in like practical approaches, this doesn't concern us because we're not interested in this like infinite entanglement at very small scales. And that motivates the idea that if we want to understand how to use tensor networks to model quantum fields, that we should use correlation functions as the target, as a cost function. Okay? We want basically understand how well, given a tensor network, how well does this tensor network can reproduce the correlation function. Okay, and this basically always also would give us basically a way how to discretize the continuum. Okay, because in some sense, if we only, as Brian pointed out, if we are only interested in a finite number of points, probably we also only interested in smooth observables, and then this, because these finite number of points are smooth observables, they're already and they're separated by some finite distance. This will give us some space, some discrete spatial structure, for which we can then write down, hopefully, a tensor network. And the idea is that this tensor network, if we calculate the correlation functions of that tensor network, that these correlation functions are approximately or provably, hopefully, equal or close to the correlation functions of that theory. Okay, and of course, what we want to show is that we want to understand certain examples where we can prove that this works. And then we want to go on this side and basically find a ways to further construct tensor networks, which then maybe can be understood to, maybe can be used to understood more general quantum features, interacting quantum. Okay? So that's the idea I want to basically promote. And I want to promote that by using two examples where we can show that it works. And the first case is conformal field theories and matrix product states. So what we can show in a work done in 2016, and now the long paper is about to be published in Nuclear Physics B, we can show that for any conformal field theory with some certain constraints, for example, it has to be unitary, then we can arbitrarily approximate the correlation functions of this CFT by the correlation functions of a matrix product tensor network. And we get provable error bounds which depend on the bond dimension, the number of insertion points, like how many elements, how many observables we probe, and a quantity which depends on the CFT, which is not always the central charge, but it's related to that in many cases. So this is really like one example of what I had on the previous slide, isn't it? We can provably construct tensor networks, which basically such that the correlation functions of that approximate the correlation functions of my quantum field theory. Of course, we need, and that makes sense, isn't it? We need that these points are separated by some finite distance, because otherwise the correlation functions diverge. And you can understand also, we can basically study how this function scales with this minimal distance. It's basically given like by these two functions. You can either fix the error or you can fix this minimal distance, and you get the following scaling. You see that this is that the scaling of the bond dimension is polynomial in 1 over epsilon in the approximation error. So it's a nice thing. Yeah. This basically tells you, isn't it, that the more, the finer you probe the system, meaning the closer the points get, the more entanglement you need, the higher the bond dimension is. This is a nice, I mean, we expect that. And the proof gives you exactly this. Yeah.
In this particular example, did you use a matrix product state to represent the wave function?
We construct, maybe, I tell some.
The notation that you use. Yeah. Suggests to me that this you are using a matrix product state for the ground state wave function, but that's not what you did.
No. Okay. Maybe I give a short outline of the proof, and maybe then it becomes clear what you did, what we did. Okay. Two remarks: the proof holds for general conformal field theories and uses the theory of vertex operator algebras. If there are any expert in the room. We need some conditions. For example, we need unitarity. Isn't it? It has to have some certain nice features. It has to be quantum conformal field theory. It's rigorous and constructive, and it also takes additional physical symmetries into account. So, for example, if the conformal field theory in question is a Vestermeer-Witten model, then this tensor network has this additional symmetry, and I will talk more about Vestermeer-Witten models in the second part of my talk. So I give you a very high level idea of the proof. I'll give you two ideas, or two ways to approach it. So one way is basically you say, you take the operator product expansion of a CFT, the OPE, which like conceptually can be written in that form, where these are primary fields and as well some descendants. And you could think of this guy to be a tensor, okay? And you could think of that guy to be as an ansatz for your matrix product things. Of course, this guy is like infinite dimensional, is it? Because these labels run over infinitely many, all elements of the tower, the conformed towers. So this wouldn't give a finite bond dimension, and you need to truncate that. Okay. And one way, in some sense, you can see one element of the proof is how to truncate OPEs of conformal field theories with exact error bounds. Okay? But there's a more geometric way of understanding what our proof does, and that's what I'm going to show you now. And it uses Siegel's definition of a conformal field theory. So Siegel's definition of a conformal field theory basically tells you that a conformal field theory should be thought of as a functor, a map, and so if you want, of the category of two-dimensional Riemannian surfaces to trace class operators on Hilbert spaces. Okay. And one particular two-dimensional surface is, for example, that one. Okay. It has holes in here. And these holes correspond to field insertions. So basically, you have this like a two-dimensional Riemannian surface, and you put holes in it if you want to probe it at certain points, and these holes correspond to field insertions. These holes are parameterized by circles, and basically the invariance of this object, if you reparameterize your circle, this gives you the action of the Virasoro algebra. Okay, in mathematical terms, this is a functor, and the deformations on one side are symmetries in the class in the category of two-dimensional Riemannian surfaces, and there should be also be symmetries on the other side. And this taking over symmetry gives you the Virasoro algebra on the in the quantum case. Okay, so in some sense, this already looks like a matrix product state. So you take this object, you decompose it into pairs. Okay. Why? And one way to draw a pair. Okay. It has three holes. That's the topological information we need. You decompose it into a pair, and then in some sense, this guy already looks like, in some sense, there's a tensor, isn't it? But actually, each pan is parameterized by three circles, and you have to label these circles by some element, alpha, beta, gamma. And labeling that means corresponding to choosing a position at that circle. And so labeled points correspond to field insertions at the circle at a certain point with some primary. Okay, and basically the value of this guy is then an OPE, is it? Because we've basically input three primary fields at certain positions, and the value, the trace class operator, which is then given by us by Siegel's definition of a CFT, is exactly an OPE. Okay, now this is an infinite dimensional object, because basically all these smooth deformations, there are infinitely many of them, isn't it? And to represent them in unitary well, we need an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. So this suggests a very nice way of truncating. We don't want to keep all the smooth deformations, but only some of them. And that's what we do. So, but first we have to require that this pan has some finite width. So we basically require that this in this direction, it has some finite width. And that basically corresponds to having a minimal distance between insertion points, isn't it? Because if I put another pan in here, that if this has a finite width, then these insertion points are separated by some finite distance. And then what we do in the next step is that we have insertion points, but we have labeled insertion points, but not at a point, but just some smooth versions of that. Okay? And because we have some smooth version of that, we cannot arbitrarily deform it anymore. We can basically say, let's only consider the deformations which basically don't make this smoothing too small. Okay? And you can show that this is basically a finite set, or can be approximated by a finite set, and such a way, and then this gives you a finite dimensional tensor. And basically that corresponds to truncating a Fourier-like basis of these circles. Or to considering smooth fields. Okay? So and this basically proves you, because I can basically show using the language of vertex operator algebra that the Siegel's definition, the geometric way of understanding conformal field theories, is equal to like the analytic expressions. And this basically tells you that if you're interested in the correlation functions of smoothed observables, you can approximate it using finite dimensions, using matrix product states of finite point dimensions. Next part, Westermine-Witten theories and Mera. So that was nice, isn't it? We used matrix product states to understand general conformal field theories, but now let's focus on a very specific class, namely Westermine-Witten models, and try to use a better way to capture entanglement, namely Mera. And we get a similar result. This is work together with Brian Zwingel and Michael Wolter. That correlation functions of smooth fields of SUM level K Westermine-Witten models can be approximated by the correlation functions of a Mera, and the function is again a function depending on the number of insertion points, the locality and the depth of the circuit, and M and K. So this should be an M and K. Okay. And again, we have an analytic construction of this mirror. These smooth fields could be taken as well as currents. Currents, these are the usual observables of a Westermine-Widmore SRS intertwiners. I'm not going to define what an intertwiner is, but for the expert, it basically mixes different modules of the CFT. And actually, it's not a simple binary mirror, but it can make into one by just regrouping the tensors. Okay. So what's the idea? Well, we just basically used a result of Witten, who proved that these special Westermine-Witten models can be realized on the Fock space of three Dirac fermions. Okay. How does that go? Well, the current, that's one set of like observable you're interested in, to associate to some element in SUM, like written down in matrix units here, is associated with an operator which is given by the sum. And here you have normal ordered products of bilinear pairs of fermion operators. And you take basically, if you have SUM level K, you take M times K, so this should be an M, sorry, M times K three Dirac fermions. You label it by two numbers, like two indices, I, which goes from 1 to M, L, which goes from 1 to K. And then you basically take this object, so you sum over them, these bilinear terms with these coefficients, which come from like this expansion, and another L, which is basically you introduce another degree of freedom, you just trace over in some sense, which is related to the level and not M. Okay? So this, and you can just show that these guys fulfill the usual OP rules of Westermine-Witten models, and basically they are faithful representation of the Westermine-Witten model. That's basically what Witten did. Okay? So the idea is very simple in some sense. We just take M times K copies of the free fermion mirror, which Brian introduced, and construct smooth version of these currents such that these smooth versions become local operators which act on this many copies of this mirror. Okay? And then, because like we can approximate smooth expectation value of smooth free fermion operators, well, then the idea is we can approximate smooth the expectation value of smooth currents. Of course, there are some difficulties in here. For example, this normal ordering, this has to be taken care of, isn't it? We have to basically replace this normal ordering with the normal operating with respect to the mirror, and we have to show that this replacing we can bound there. Okay? But this can be done. Okay, I'll give you now the construction. So let's say we have one mirror here, and this is supposed to be like the mirror Brian introduced, isn't it? It comes from a continuous wavelet transform associated with Selesnik's waveless-based Hilbert transform pairs. It has some nice features I want to point out. It gives provable error bounds, as Brian pointed out. But it actually can also be used to approximate the ground state of free fermions in a 1D and a 2D lattice. Here, you would need a branching mirror, but we can show how to do that. And it basically follows from the same kind of construction. This is joint work with Yuto, Jordan Kotler, who's also here, and Matthias Bahl from Ghent. And we will go again using the exact same mirror to approximate correlation functions of Westermine-Witten field theories. Right? So just take now M times K is copies of that. And each index, basically, each spatial index here now has like dimension 2 times M times K, isn't it? At each index, you can have a fermion or not. And then one lattice side is basically all of these. So now we have to come up, I mean, that's nice, isn't it? So this is just a mirror. But now we have to come up how to represent our currents in that setup. And this is a non-trivial task because the currents are not like a not smooth version, first of all. Okay. So what we need to show is that to come up with an approximate version of smooth currents. And what a smooth current does, in some way you can understand, is mixing these different mirrors. Okay? Or maybe a smooth current, as we have here. What it does, it mixes the different fermions. It creates a, it destroys a fermion, creates a fermion, a different fermion. So what it basically does, depending on this matrix I, it mixes the different fermions. And that's what we want to simulate, which basically means that we take this guy and mix them depending on a function on this object A, which is an SUM. Okay, so we basically mix these different meras in terms of the smoothed version of our current. Okay, now you see that we have this additional sum over L, which basically is not mixing, isn't it? And that actually means that SUM does not act irreducible on each side, isn't it? Because you have this multiplicity sitting in there of the fermions you don't mix. So what you can do, you can basically understand, you have to basically look at this tensor network and basically decompose it into irreducible components of this action. And what basically happens is that you can do so at the top layer to choose, basically at the top layer you can choose a certain irreducible component, and then this many layers will basically fall into, well, if you choose a certain prime, that this would correspond to a primary field in some sense, this would correspond to one tensor network, which is not anymore a tensor network which is free. I mean, these were all tensor networks for free theories, isn't it? But by basically looking at the irreducible components and projecting onto one irreducible component, this becomes not free. So this is a way to construct a tensor network for interacting conform field theory, which provably gives you the correlation functions. Okay, and yeah, so this basically for the expert corresponds to selecting one Westermine-Witten module in the Fock space. Okay, so you can show that the whole free fermion Fock space decomposes under the action of these currents into irreducible modules. Finitely many of them, and each of them is basically one representation of my symmetry action and corresponds to one primary field in some sense. Well, because it does so, by looking at how the different way how this guy decomposes, you can recover the fusion rules and you can prove that they're exact. However, this projection doesn't actually reduce the entanglement a lot, but that's expected, isn't it? I mean, this one shouldn't have much less entanglement as these three ones, isn't it? So in some sense, from a computational entanglement perspective, whether you do this projection or not doesn't matter so much. And of course, you can only do so if you're interested in the correlation function in one module. Okay, if you're interested in correlation functions where you have intertwiners which mix these different modules, then of course you have to take the whole mera, because only in this one you have all the modules represented, isn't it? Of course you could think, and then you basically could think of the intertwiners as transforming these different tensor networks into each other. But you can also think of them as basically acting on this, on these many layers of the free fermion mera. Okay, conclusion and outlook. I hope I convinced you that tensor networks can faithfully represent conformal field theories if you are interested in approximating correlation functions. And we can, for certain cases, we can really prove that this is the case. I presented two results in that direction. First, I showed that we can use matrix product states to approximate the correlation functions of general conformal field theories using, in an intuitive way, Segal's definition of a CFT. And I showed how to use mera, the free fermion mera, which is exact, like can be, is approximately giving you the correlation functions of free fermions. How do you can use many copies of that to show and to give a mera for this SUM level K Westermine-Witten model theories. And again, I want to emphasize that the key idea in obtaining all these results were that the aim was to approximate correlation functions of smooth observables. And if you do so, then if that's your aim, then you can obtain these results. And the error functions will depend on how many insertions you have and how well you can approximate these correlation functions. And that will give you what tensor network you like. Isn't it? And the finer you go, meaning the less smooth the functions are, and the more functions you need, the more complicated the tensor network has to be. And this ties in exactly what Brian was saying. That the tensor network you write down depends on like how many details you want to capture. And the more details you want to capture, the more complicated the tensor network becomes. And we have seen two examples where we can really quantify how this goes. And we really can understand, and of course, like the tensor network basically tells us how the entanglement goes. So like we can really understand the finer, the more information we want to probe from the system, the more entanglement we need in some sense to describe that. Okay? And that these approximations basically tell us, okay, if we are only interested in information at a certain scale, then only a certain amount of entanglement is relevant. And I mean, we kind of all know that, but this is like a nice analytic, I think, verification of that fact. And with that, I would like to thank you.
Can you, maybe it's related to the Western equation model, can you consider a symmetric orbital solder of this free theory?
I haven't thought about that much, but I think it can be done.
Yeah, I think it can. I mean, we talked about this like years ago.
Yeah.
I think it can be done.
Next step.
What about anionic CFTs?
Well, what do you mean, these CFTs, I mean, they are related to, like, if you're, for example, for Semino-Witten, isn't it? They have, like, anionic. If you think of them, they have anionic excitations, isn't it? So, I mean, this, like, the primaries in some sense, and maybe it's nice if you go back. So, in some sense, this Funke representation, isn't it? If you forget in the Funke, this local information at which point in the circle you are, you're kind of already at a topological field theory. And this, in some way, the connection between conformal field theories and topological conformal field theories.
So with regard to your MPS result, is there any way of using that technology or to leverage that to have some variational principle for interacting conformal field theories?
Well, I mean, this is for general. I mean, we are...
Well, yeah, but you need the data of the conformal
yes.
field theory to construct it.
Yes. Maybe. I cannot answer that out of hand. I think Mera is, I think, at the moment, I think Mera is more suited to, like, these, like, optimization answers. But, yeah,
okay.
Talk to me in half a year, probably have changed my opinion.
So this was kind of a very special case, the Semino-Witten case, where you can use free fermion theories, mix them up, and create something nice.
Well,
is it?
Yes, but you could use, for example, I mean, so if you do Semino-Witten and then look at orbifold constructions or like coset construction, then the idea is that you can basically capture all rational CFTs.
Okay.
So like starting from that, the next step is obviously doing coset construction, which of course also would take your free fermion Mera and make a non-free version out of it. But you still have a very good way to control that because, like, you understand what coset construction is. So you can, basically, would basically mean you take these many layers of free fermion and factor out certain symmetries, and by that again also some sort of project down these many layers, and we also get an interacting. But you would have control over it, isn't it?
Right.
So and then I think you could study a large class of like rational conformal field theory.
If there are no further questions, let's thank Parker again.